Good afternoon, everybody, on this wonderful Tuesday afternoon. It is January 24th, 2023. This is the first Health and Social Services Committee from the Senate. We do have a quorum to conduct business. We're meeting today in room 205 of the Capitol Building. Please remember to silence your cell phones as a courtesy. Today, we have Senator Dunbar, Senator Tobin, Vice Chair, Senator Kaufman, and myself, Senator Wilson. We are expecting Senator DeGiesel. She is off on other state business. Welcome back. I'd like to introduce some of our folks we have working for the committee. And here we have our trustee A, who's been here 7 years, working the Health and Social Services Committee. Many, many, many moons, I believe, over 500 moons working here for this Senate. That's Ms. Jody Simpson, our committee aide. We also have our Senate reporter, Mary Gwynn, over there, and also working our moderator here is Kelsey behind the screen and behind the monitor. We also, I believe, may have Senator Clayman joining us in the audience, and maybe some other members from the other body coming in joining us as well. This afternoon, we do have a overview from the Department of Health, but just as a quick reminder of just how things will flow normally in the committee, when we have presentations, if there are questions, we normally stop at the end of the slide to allow members to ask questions. But today, just because of the greatness of sort of the material that the department needs to cover, I'm just going to ask if you guys can just hold off on your questions unless there are clarifying questions and you just need something to be restated by the department or the presenter. Please ask those, but we do want to make sure there will be enough time for questions, but we just want to make sure we can get through some of the background information and discussion before we get down to some of the topics that I believe are interests of the committee members. Form of questions, we try not to do policy statements in the committee, but if you do like to make statements like that, we try to hold those to the end where we allow for the sort of the closing comments, questions from committee members to do that. We try to start on time and end on time because there's a lot of other business going on in the state, and we understand that different conflicting meetings may come up, and so at that time, please just let our office know so we can just excuse you, but as soon as we get three people in the committee, I'll hit that gavel at 3:30. So with that, we will go off and we'll invite Commissioner Designee Heidi Hedberg to the table, as long as with any other individual she would like to have there with her to start us off. Here also in the room, we also have the Deputy Commissioner, Ms. Emily Ritchie. We have our Chief Medical Officer, Ms. Ann Zink. And we have Josie Stern, Assistant to the Commissioner and the Finance Management Services person, Josie Stern, right? And we also have one of our favorite folks in the audience who's a longtime friend of the Senate as well, Ms. Heather Carpenter, who's one of their policy, along with, Courtney is also here from the division as well. And with that, Commissioner Designee, the floor is yours. Once you introduce yourself, put yourself on the record, and you may begin when you're ready.
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner Designee.
We're taking Eddie's. I don't think that's working. All right, back on the record for another sound test, Commissioner.
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner Designee, and thank you for inviting us and doing a department overview. My first slide was to actually introduce our team. So thank you, Senator Wilson. I am actually really humbled and thankful for the team that is leading the department. It's going to take all of us. So with that, I'm actually going to introduce Dr. Ann Zink, our Chief Medical Officer, and she's going to present the first three slides. And I'll just give context that these three slides are on the state of health, and it really provides that high-level briefing and framework for the department and the conversation that we're going to have today.
Thanks, Commissioner. For the record, I am Dr. Ann Zink. I'm the Chief Medical Officer for the state of Alaska. I'm really honored to serve in this role, to work with professionals both inside the state as well as across Alaska to serve the health and well-being of Alaskans. But what makes up their health and well-being is very varied and diverse. Over 80% of our health is determined by things outside of healthcare. and making sure that we have person-centric and whole systems that serve people is really the mission of what we're doing within the Department of Health. Our mission is to serve Alaskans, to make sure that we are promoting and protecting the health, well-being, and self-sufficiency of Alaskans. So be it their mental health, their economic stability, the cost of healthcare, their access to healthcare, all these things play a phenomenal role in the actual health of an individual patient and why we really work within the Department of Health as well as across other departments and with our tribal partners, our healthcare providers, our local entities across the state, and you all here today to do what we can to really fulfill that mission. So we really appreciate the time and opportunity to be here. So a question we oftentimes get asked is, well, what does that mean? What is the health and well-being of Alaskans? How do you measure that, and what does that look like? And I have a lot of data with us, and we can talk about a lot of data from different perspectives, but a couple ways that we oftentimes talk about health and well-being is in life expectancy, how long people live, as well as the cost of our care and why people get ill, why people die, and looking at the upstream factors. So you can see the graph on the right is life expectancy at birth versus healthcare expenditures per capita. This was updated as of 2020. Unfortunately, we don't have data more recently than that. And you can see a couple things. This continues to change over time, state to state, but looking at the 2020 data, Alaska continues to be a pretty expensive place to get healthcare. So it's the second most expensive place in the country if you're looking at healthcare expenditures per capita, just behind New York. Interestingly, most of the rural states led that for quite a while, but now we're starting to see some shifts and changes along those lines. But we're right kind of in the middle for life expectancy. So you can see that we're 29th in the nation for life expectancy. We can see some states like Hawaii up there has the highest life expectancy, while Mississippi, West Virginia are lagging with the lowest life expectancy across the country. There's many reasons for the way that healthcare is delivered. It's complex, it's nuanced. We like to find widgets that are going to solve the whole problem, but the reality is it's complex, and we need to understand the complexity of both the delivery of care as well as what people need. One way that we look at it is, why are people dying, and what are those leading causes of death? And there's a lot of different ways to look at it, but for simplicity, we brought this slide on the left here, and this is the leading causes of death in Alaska versus the United States. And you can see the United States and Alaska continue to have, this is 2021 data, had the same top three leading causes of death: cancer, heart disease, and COVID. Clearly, COVID was not a leading cause of disease years ago, and that really popped up in the last couple years, and hopefully going to see that diminishing here over time. You can see that in Alaska, compared to the United States as a whole, we really stand out statistically in three major areas, and that's in accidents, suicide, and liver disease, and those are highlighted in the bright red kind of percentile right there. We could talk at length about the underlying causes of disease, but want to just kind of highlight the causes of disease and the causes of death in Alaska, as well as the cost of care. So a question we oftentimes get asked is, well, what are you doing about it? How are you making that better? What does that look like? And I just wanted to point us to Alaska's Health Improvement Plan. This has been going on for decades now. It's called Healthy Alaskans. This is a project that is done in combination with our partners. It's led between the tribes and the state, co-led, where we identify what are measurable, actionable items that we can do to improve the state of Alaska's health. We set goals for every 10 years. We have already created our 2030 strategic plan, and we have outlines of exactly every year what sort of difference we're making on each of those. So looking at healthy weight, nutrition, environmental health, healthcare access, alcohol, tobacco, and substance misuse, mental health and suicide, injury and violence, infectious disease, cancer and chronic disease, and social and protective factors. And so the final 2020 report card is just coming out, and then the 2022 update for how we're doing on this year is just about to be released as well, and happy to provide more information on that. So with that, I will hand it over to Commissioner Designee Hedberg.
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner Designee. And so I am very excited to talk about the Healthy Families Initiative, because strong families are the foundation for a healthy society and vibrant economy. And there's three fundamental pillars to this initiative. It's healthy beginnings, healthcare access, which includes behavioral health and healthy communities. The first pillar, healthy beginnings, is the cornerstone of healthy families. This pillar prioritizes maternal and child health. It emphasizes preventative measures for youth, like healthy diets and physical activity, and works towards expanding and improving child care and after-school programs. The second pillar, improving access to health care, addresses both access to mental health and physical health, which is fundamental to healthy families. This pillar is focusing on working with partners to create a robust and resilient healthcare workforce. It's also supporting aging in place and aligning how we pay for healthcare to reflect better outcomes and higher value for the whole person care. And then finally, the third pillar, healthy communities, builds on existing efforts to create healthy workplaces and works with partners to increase safe and affordable housing. It will reduce the burden of infectious diseases such as tuberculosis and address chronic diseases by launching the Fresh Start campaign to connect Alaskans to prevention programs. So this initiative is supported by ongoing federal and general funds. And I also want to acknowledge that a lot of these strategies exist. And so this initiative is going to elevate those existing programs in addition to expansion and new ideas that are coming to fruition. And really, it's a partnership across departments with communities and businesses and Alaskans. Again, as Dr. Anzink mentioned, health is not just the Department of Health, it's the collection of all state agencies, communities, businesses working together. With that, I'm going to invite Dr. Anzink back up to discuss Office of Health Savings.
Great. Again, for the record, I'm Dr. Anzink, and an additional initiative, so Commissioner Designee just highlighted Healthy Families, which is a super exciting initiative to move forward, but we've also put forward the Office of Health Savings. And this is not just healthcare dollar savings, but also saving people's health. And that's why we titled it Office of Health Savings. We do know that healthy people are cheaper people and that healthy economies are built with healthy people. And so that's why it is fundamentally important that we think about the cost of care as well as how we improve health, particularly thinking about prevention. This will be initially positioned within the Department of Health Commissioner's Office. And initial savings is really focused on the Medicaid program, but then building upon that, bringing in innovative payment models to really look at how we're paying for specifically pharmaceuticals, how we're building across payer types. As a provider, they want to know that provider types and payer types are aligned in the way that they're able to provide care, not having to think about how is Medicaid doing this differently than the Department of and the Division of Insurance, so really being able to braid that. And then we continue to see that pharmacy costs are a driving sector of the healthcare industry, so what can be done about pharmacy costs, as well as improved access to clinical medication. We saw this during the COVID-19 pandemic with access to things like Paxlovid. What ways can we work with the federal government across the agencies to make sure that key medications are available to people in Alaska regardless of their cost or insurance type and ability to pay? And on the right here, you see a graph just over time where we've seen healthcare expenditures per capita, which I mentioned previously compared to other states. But here it looks over time how Alaska versus the United States, how it's really diverged really since about 2000. And why we have a lot of work to do in this area, and I'm looking forward to the opportunity. And with that, I'll hand it back.
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner Designee. So slide 7 is a visual that is really just sharing, prior to July 1st, it was the Department of Health and Social Services. On July 1st of 2022, there was a department split, and there was two departments created, the Department of Health and the Department of Family and Community Services. So on this slide is just a reminder of the divisions and how they split between both departments. So slide 8, the Department of Health and the Department of Family and Community Services continues to coordinate on improving the continuum of care for person-centered care, and have been working together on complex care coordination by addressing gaps in access to care so that the system works for the person and the person doesn't get lost in the bureaucracy of the government programs or the healthcare system. The two departments still share IT resources and are working on a roadmap to separate the IT resources. The May 2021 cyber attack highlighted the technology debt and overburdened and overtaxed IT systems. And this roadmap will support both departments navigating the necessary resources to support the HIPAA-compliant services for Alaskans. And so this slide is really just kind of talking about the department split and really the work that continues to happen between both departments. Slide 9 is our financial management services, and this division supports the work of the commissioner's office and the 5 programmatic divisions by providing essential services to the department through specialized sections, such as the Medicaid Program Integrity, the Office of Rate Review, the Health Information Systems, the Medicaid Allocation and Audit Services, also known as MAS, And then we have the grants, contracts, revenue, finance, facilities, audit, and budget. Really, I think about the Financial Management Services Division, it's really the spine or the backbone that really supports the entire department. And there's two key areas that I just wanted to highlight. In our grants and contracts they coordinate over $173 million in FY22 to over 500 grantees that included nonprofits and municipal governments. And the Medicaid Integrity Recovery, or avoiding costs from fraud, waste, and abuse investigations, they were able to recover $7.8 million in FY22. The next couple of slides, I'm going to invite Deputy Commissioner Emily Ritchie up to describe her division.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Emily Ricci. I am Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Health. And the next few slides are a very brief overview of the key divisions that combined make up Alaska's Medicaid program. The first division I'm going to speak to today is the Division of Senior and Disability Services. This division is focused on serving Alaskans with disabilities and those who are elderly or vulnerable. The division has approximately 170 staff that provide a wide range of services. Some of the more well-known programs are listed on this slide. But I would note that these are just a snapshot of the programs. This is not exhaustive. One of the most important things this division does is to administer the home and community-based waivers. Alaska has a long-standing position of working to assist individuals in remaining independent and in their homes and communities as long as possible. These programs allow for Medicaid to cover home and community-based services for individuals who would otherwise be served in institutions or nursing homes. There are five different waivers that the division manages, focusing on different categories of needs and care services. In FY22, approximately 5,500 Alaskans were served by these waivers, covering nearly $281 million in total services. Other programs managed by the division include Adult Protective Services, the Infant Learning Program, and the General Relief Program. Again, this list is not exhaustive, just highlighting a few that you may have heard of. The team in the division works very hard to ensure the programs they offer are robust. One of their accomplishments was a 10% Medicaid rate increase for home and community-based providers, which was included in the FY23 operating budget. These new rates took effect July 1st, and we appreciate the legislature's support in making that happen. The division also leveraged $8 million in federal funds for two projects. The first focused on providing short-term relief to providers to cover recruitment and retention costs, and the second to establish a training and certification program for direct support professionals through the University of Alaska Anchorage. Around 225 providers benefited from the short-term relief, and 115 direct support professionals are enrolled in the UAA program. The division also took lessons learned from the pandemic and adopted some regulatory changes focused on promoting safe and flexible options. These include things like allowing first aid training for providers to be completed online, and expanding the use of video and teleconference services for care coordination. Moving to slide 11, we're going to talk about the Division of Healthcare Services. I think of this division as the heartbeat of the Medicaid program. Staffed with around 180 positions, this division is responsible for the claims processing and the payment system for almost all Medicaid services. This means they are managing weekly check writes of between $45 and $50 million while processing nearly 6.3 million claims in FY22. In addition, the division manages several different units with functions that impact healthcare services and providers around the state. This includes a background check unit, the residential licensing and facilities licensing units, the pharmacy program, the transportation unit, and the tribal reclaiming unit. One of the largest challenges for healthcare services this year was staffing. This was felt most acutely in the background check unit, where high absences and staff vacancies, which experienced high absences and staff vacancies. This was combined with a manual processing cleanup project from the cyber attack and additional provider behavioral health provider types, which increased the number of applications they were processing this fall. This was really good for our behavioral health system in terms of having higher different types of providers that could submit applications, but ultimately resulted in longer than standard turnaround times and delays this fall. Since December, the unit seems to be back at full capacity, and processing times have dropped to 4 business days following receipt of a complete application. We know this is an area of difficulty for providers, and we're committed to finding ways to improve the process, but I'm glad to report that we are back down to our standard processing times. Healthcare Services has had some substantial successes. An important item was the procurement and award of the fiscal agent contract. Fiscal agent services are a core component of how the division processes claims, and rebidding these services is a highly complex process and challenging. The division completed the procurement and a contract was awarded to HMS this fall. This means that a portion of the work currently performed by Conduit will transition to HMS April 1st, so something the division is highly focused on. Other successes focused on meaningful savings. Some highlights include over $155 million in claims recovery, where another payer would potentially be the primary payer for those claims, so ensuring that Medicaid is the payer of last resort. $45 million in savings from leveraging pharmacy discounts and efficient management, and $75 million in tribal reclaiming. And these savings are preliminary. They're on the low end. We expect them to grow.
And for the record, we are joined by Senator Giesel.
So moving on to slide 12, we're going to talk a little bit about the Division of Behavioral Health. This division is responsible for the publicly funded behavioral health continuum of care. It has 123 positions and an annual budget of around $96 million. The division has five operational sections managing several programs. Some of those include the Tobacco Enforcement Program, the Alcohol Safety Program, Treatment and Recovery Coordination and Support, and the Suicide Prevention Program. The division also manages a robust collection of treatment and recovery grants to community providers. The treatment and recovery team within the division managed roughly 180 grant awards in FY22, so it's an important component of the behavioral health system. The division provides a continuum of statewide behavioral health services, so mental health and substance use, ranging from prevention and screening to brief intervention and acute psychiatric care. One of the most important initiatives managed by the division is the expansion of covered behavioral health services through the implementation of a Medicaid Section 1115 waiver. This innovative Medicaid demonstration project allows the state to bill Medicaid for services that would otherwise not be covered. The purpose of the 1115 waiver was to establish a continuum of behavioral health services at the community and regional level by allowing providers to bill Medicaid for new or expanded service types, including crisis intervention and peer support services. In FY22, nearly $190 million in waiver claims were paid and processed. The waiver was fully implemented in 2020 and is currently in the process of renewal. Additionally, the division has proposed a 4.5% rate increase for 1115 waiver services that is currently in the regulatory process. We just wrapped up public comment, and so we'll be moving on to the next step. The Division of Behavioral Health, in collaboration with the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, continues to work with community providers to support the development and implementation of the Crisis Now model, which is a systemic approach to building a robust behavioral health continuum of care. That has been an important part of our conversations over the last few months and years. Over the next 2 years, the division will be organizing and implementing technical assistance for organizations around the state who have expressed the interest in building, in providing 23-hour crisis observation and stabilization services, another key component of the Crisis Now model. And we are looking forward to continuing to build out that model and those services. So I think with that, I sped through those slides, and we'll pass it back to Commissioner Designee. Thank you.
Great, and I'm going to invite Dr. Ann Zink up. She oversees the Division of Public Health.
Great, thanks, Commissioner. For the record, I'm Dr. Ann Zink, Chief Medical Officer for the State of Alaska. While Emily described healthcare services as the heart, I would describe the Division of Public Health as the brains and the hands of healthcare. So we really work as kind of the chief strategist, thinking about health prevention and promotion and how we move upstream, but we also work very closely in communities and getting a lot of community support out there. Many other states have local public health jurisdictions. We have a very centralized public health section, which allows our epidemiologists to work across the state, and that is really then run through the public health nursing center that has nurses across the state. We have over 500 people who are in our division and eight very distinct sections that do all sorts of really creative, interesting, and meaningful work, including the Chronic Disease Prevention and Health Promotion Team. When we're looking at Medicaid expenditure and overall healthcare expenditure, chronic disease continues to be one of the major driving forces of cost to healthcare. And so that team very much is thinking and working closely. And in fact, some of the Healthy Alaskan goals and the work that's done within that section are now built into the MESA report on Medicaid. So really trying to work with those divisions together. Our section of epidemiology is probably fairly well known to most Alaskans after the past few years, but looking at disease investigation and promotion, one of their major hurdles right now is, unfortunately, we've seen a real rise in sexually transmitted diseases, particularly syphilis, as well as TB. We have about 3 times the rate of tuberculosis in the state as the rest of the country, and we've had some of the highest cases on record in the last 10 years, really rising over the last year. So very concerned about our TB cases, and that team's working very diligently on that. Our health and vital record, our health analytics and vital records, birth certificates, death certificates, our death reviews, helping us to understand the data. And the limitations in our kind of IT and data systems continue to be challenging, which Commissioner highlighted earlier, and that team was really impacted by the cyber attack, but is really pretty much fully recovered at this point. Our state public health labs is a vital part of our entire healthcare system. They do provide certain services in our state that other healthcare industries cannot provide, certain testing. For example, you know, when COVID-19 hit, no one had testing for that. We also did not have any commercial laboratory testing for COVID-19 in the state, and we were deprioritized in all of the commercial labs in the lower 48 based on our population size. So our local public health lab stood in that gap for multiple months until the commercial sector could stand in. They also do a lot of our HIV testing, our genomic sequence associated with both that and other diseases, hepatitis C testing, including a lot of our prison outwork, and all sorts of other infectious diseases. So a key part of kind of the surveillance and understanding of disease mitigation within our state. Our public health nursing, as mentioned, is kind of that hands within communities, and really grateful for their on-the-ground support and work. One real highlight that I wanted to emphasize over this past year is we were able to eliminate the age restrictions that had been put into place previously because of budgetary restrictions. So now our public health nursing centers are open to serve people of all ages, which has been a great success, a relief to our team, and I think really helping to serve communities in a different way than we were able to be beforehand. Our rural community health systems describe themselves the other day as the catch-all, but they do all sorts of things. They're overseeing the EMS system. Our rural systems, they are helping to look at hospitals and hospital capacity. They're currently hiring for a homelessness position. So they're very much thinking about the rural and community health systems and making sure our hospital systems are all connected. For example, our hospitals have been very overwhelmed recently, as well as during COVID. They run a daily huddle with the hospitals and have a clinician that helps to support back transferring and moving with patients and then working with our Medicaid team to make sure that there's payment from that on the back end. We have such limited healthcare capacity in the state that making sure that we're using every resource that we possibly can. Some recent successes is two of our hospitals, Fairbanks and Mat-Su, have been able to bring on dialysis because of the support with that team and really kind of been able to expand the capacity that has allowed more of our state to be able to kind of take the burden and load when we have more patients entering our hospital systems, keeping more people in the state and helping to support each other. Our state medical examiners, we don't have coroners or county coroners in the state. We have one state medical examiners. And so this really helps to identify causes of death, critical role for understanding what's happening in the opioid epidemic and the reasons for people's death, and grateful for their team. And the Women and Children and Family and Families Health Unit does amazing work thinking about family partnerships, the ways that women and children can be supported through this critical time, and will be playing a key role in the Healthy Families Initiative. So thanks for the time, and I'll hand it back over.
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner Designee. And so I oversee the Division of Public Assistance. And I think that's going to be the bulk of the rest of our time today is really diving into the Division of Public Assistance, the programs that they oversee, and talking about the SNAP backlog and answering some of your questions. So I just want to highlight that the Division of Public Assistance promotes self-sufficiency and provides basic living expenses to Alaskans in need. The division oversees 18 programs and provides public assistance to 1 out of 3 Alaskans. And I'm going to spend a little bit of time going over those 18 programs just again to create that visual for you. There are 8 different food and nutrition assistance programs. The SNAP, or the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, the SNAP Education Program, SNAP-ED. There's the Women, Infant, Children, Breastfeeding Peer Counseling Program, Commodities Supplemental Food Program, WIC Farmers Market Nutrition Program, Senior Farmers Market Nutrition Program, and then finally the Pandemic EBT, or the Electronic Benefit Transfer. And those are funds that are given to kids that are eligible for free lunches. So during the pandemic, when they missed school, these were funds to help those kiddos. And that's a partnership between the Department of Ed and the Department of Health. So those are the 8 programs for food, nutrition, and assistance. The next 2 is medical assistance. So there's 2 primary programs, Medicaid, and then the second is chronic and acute medical assistance, also known as CAMI. The next category is the assistance for seniors and disabilities. There's 2 programs. It's the adult public assistance and senior benefit programs. The next category is heating and water assistance. Water assistance is new. That started in December of 2022. And so there's 3 programs. There's the heating assistance program, the water assistance program, and then the Alaska Affordable Health Program. The next category is assistance for families with dependent children. There's 2 programs, the Alaska Temporary Assistance Program and the Child Care Assistance Program. And finally, the last category is we have a general relief assistance, and that really provides emergent basic needs for shelter, utilities, food, clothing, or burial. The division most predominantly sees requests for burial assistance. So those are the 18 programs. And I just want to highlight that $95.5 million in COVID relief funds for child care was distributed, and they provided public assistance to around 300,000 Alaskans per month. So let's dive into the causes of the SNAP backlog. I started my position as commissioner designee November 16th, 2022. And I've spent the last 2.5 months focusing on the DPA and understanding the programs, workflows, delays, and identifying solutions to address the immediate and long-term needs of the division. And in my role, I've outreached and listened to clients impacted by the backlog. I have called clients. I have listened to their stories. I've also talked with and met with providers, service providers, and advocacy groups who are hearing and seeing the direct impacts from the delayed assistance. I've called and I've talked with the governor's office, constituent relations, and the ombudsman's office because both of those groups have been overwhelmed by frustrated callers. And I've listened to the ASEA union share their concerns for the field staff at the DPA offices. And I've visited 2 DPA offices, and I've talked with the staff to hear their frustrations, concerns, and solutions. And then there's a daily huddle meeting, and when I'm able to, I attend that meeting. And that's really, it's 10 minutes, and they're triaging their staff and workflow efficiencies and getting that information out to the field staff. I share all of this to demonstrate that I recognize the impacts of these delays that are having on Alaskans and that I'm doing everything in my power to focus on solutions so we can address the immediate crisis and mitigate future disruptions. In my short 2 months, there's sort of 3 high-level causes for the backlog, and that's due to the legacy IT systems, a cyber attack that delayed the planned improvements to those IT systems, and the burden of the pandemic that required additional manual processing of benefits to eligible Alaskans. And when I say manual processes, it's Excel documents, just to be very clear. So next slide. So when I visited the Anchorage DPA office, a couple of weeks prior to my visit, I had received information that 2 of the DPA employees had performed CPR on a client that had collapsed in the hallway. And I wanted to personally go hear their story, to listen, and to thank them for just stepping up when they saw the need. And it was great to have them kind of reflect back what happened and, again, to thank them for their service. I also wanted to just spend time with an eligibility technician to truly understand why you can't click a button to issue benefits. In the year of 2023, with this backlog, I'm a hands-on person, I'm visual, I really just needed to understand what was going on, and so I go to the source. And so there was this wonderful eligibility technician, and I'll share the story. She called herself a COVID baby. She was hired during the pandemic, to help out with the manual processes, and then she has trained up. And she worked in a beautiful office. You have to imagine when you walk in, there are four screens. There is one computer in front of her with a keyboard, and then she had a separate keyboard, and she had a pad of paper. And I said, you know, just relax, just show me your process. I don't want to interrupt. I just want to visually see what it's like. And so she went to the virtual call center. She pulled the information that goes into the workflow management system, collected that information, and then she proceeded for the next 40 minutes. The picture that you see is that is called COBOL. That's the name of the ancient language, the IT language. This is one of the systems that they use. This system was created in 1959. And this is currently what they're still using. This is the Eligibility Information System, also known as EIS. And so what she did was she would go into these various systems. This is a legacy system, the picture that you see. There's eight other systems, nine total, that she would have to go navigate through that are more modernized. She had to copy and paste and re-enter client information to weave together the verification and determination in order to process those benefits. I sat with her for 40 minutes and she still hadn't completed the task. And again, it was not because I was asking questions. It's because that's how long it takes to maneuver through these systems. So I share that story to give context to sort of the understanding of what, you know, why it's taking so long to kind of address and get through these backlogs. So slide 17, so most eligibility technicians need access to nine different systems to process a client's application. These systems are not integrated and require login and logout of each system and copying and pasting client's information between each system to verify or issue benefits. Some of these systems are more updated than the older systems, known as EIS, which is predominantly used for SNAP and, again, built on that 1959 technology. We struggle to find employees who can program the languages to update the EIS system. We are working with the Office of Information Technology, also known as OIT, and our department IT to continue to find staff contractors that are available that can, again, provide that assistance for the reprogramming of the EIS system. We do have one programmer, a state employee, who's able to manage that, and she has two small contracts who's able to do the maintenance, but it's really hard to progress through that reprogramming. And so that's one of these key pinch points that we've identified that we are focusing on getting additional contractors that know how to program the mainframe. The immediate goal, again, as I said, is to hire additional programmers to finish the updates to the EIS system and then position the EIS system to be in a place where we can finish the migration into ARIES. ARIES is the newer system that has half of those programs. The ARIES system is newer and can be more easily programmed. It's not based on the mainframe. The long-term solution is to move SNAP and the other public assistance programs off of the legacy EIS, again, to be done with that mainframe and into ARIES. So for slide 18, I'm going to invite Deputy Commissioner Emily Ricci up, and she's going to talk about SNAP and Medicaid.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health. So in November, I should say, I started probably about 10 days before Commissioner-designee Hedberg. And so in November, we worked with the Division of Public Assistance, and they formed a group of technicians that was specifically assigned to be working to begin working through the older SNAP recertifications and applications. Currently, all September recertification benefits have been issued. The team is currently working through October recertifications and saw the number of recertifications being processed daily increase substantially last week, which is positive. That being said, I know that we are towards the end of January, and the division is still working through October, which is not acceptable for those Alaskans who are in need and are entitled to benefits. We understand that and are completely focused on addressing this. In a few slides, we will talk about some of the efforts underway to fix this. But while the focus is on the SNAP program, the backlog has also had an impact on certain Medicaid applications and renewals. The same team that is focusing on processing the outstanding SNAP applications would also be processing the Medicaid applications. This shift in focus, combined with the overall backlog of applications, means that some Medicaid applications are delayed. These include new Medicaid applications submitted without a SNAP application at the same time, as well as those stored in the legacy EIS system, which we've talked about, that may be coded as requiring recertification. So it's not all applications. There are some specific groups. A compounding factor is the influx of new applications from the annual open enrollment period for the federally facilitated marketplace, also known as like the healthcare exchange. Those applications are sent over if they're deemed eligible for Medicaid services versus the federal marketplace. Those are transitioned over to DPA for processing. And those resulted in an influx of additional applications during that period, which is typical, but given where we're at with backlog and the additional workload, it is additional volume to be aware of. It is difficult to estimate how many applications are delayed because the system is unable to determine duplicate applications, those which have been processed and may still be listed in the system in error, or those which have been submitted in error. So it's very challenging given the limitations with the systems that we have. Generally, Medicaid enrollment can be retroactive 90 days past the day an eligible application was received. So if an individual submitted their Medicaid application in January but received services in December, and that application is later processed in February, the services that were received in December for that individual would be within that 90-day period, and those claims would be reprocessed. So there is some benefit to that. I think with that, we're going to move to the next slide.
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner Designee. So slide 19, I actually have two slides on the virtual call center. This slide is going to talk about the intent of the virtual call center, and the next slide will talk about the challenges. So one in three Alaskans, as I mentioned, rely on public assistance. And since the inception of DPA, we have struggled to serve all Alaskans equitably because there's only 11 DPA offices that are across the state. The solution was to create a virtual call center to ensure equitable access to all Alaskans and address the overcrowded offices that have at times has had unsafe situations for clients and employees. The goal of the virtual call center that went live April 2021 was to allow clients to call and talk with an eligibility technician, have their application processed during the call. Between April 2021 and September 2022, when a client called and talked with an eligibility technician, their application was processed during the call. That all changed in October of 2022 when DPA was overwhelmed with callers. So slide 20 kind of talks about the challenges. So in October, when the call volume peaked at 2,000 calls a day, the change was made to place our newer eligibility technicians with support from seasoned staff on the virtual call center to collect the basic information and our seasoned eligibility technicians on processing applications. This allowed clients to talk with an eligibility technician and answer basic questions. DPA was also able to answer more callers with this change. In addition, on Wednesdays, additional staff are reassigned from the call center to process applications to try and get ahead. They call that their production day. I understand that there's a lot of frustrations with the call center. There are reports of people waiting for hours, and I want to acknowledge that there are long wait times. We've all been stuck on hold on our own, you know, as we call in. We have all been stuck on that, and I can tell you after 5 to 10 minutes, we've all experienced those frustrations. So I acknowledge that there are hours that people are waiting. But at the end of the day, the calls all end. And so that call ends at the end of the day, and then it starts fresh during the next day. So I just wanted to clarify that information. So I've talked about the 18 programs, the Division of Public Assistance overseas. We've talked about what caused the backlog. I've given you a story and illustration of the IT and sort of the work that's been happening. Really, my focus has been what are the issues, what are the solutions, how can we move forward? And so I want to talk about five immediate solutions that we're focusing on right now. The first, as I mentioned, is pursuing those contractors to program the eligibility information system. We know this is critical if we're going to continue with those updates so that we can position the EIS system to then be migrated over to areas. So we are, again, looking at additional contractors. It is hard to find individuals that know those antiquated IT languages. So that has been challenging for us. The second is we are pursuing a contract to support the virtual call center. It's a staffing contract. And so the goal is to take our state employees that are seasoned and trained and by federal requirements have to make those determination eligibility. They're going to be focusing on processing the application. Temporarily, we are looking at a staffing contract with a known vendor that actually knows our systems. We already have a working relationship with them. We are going to contract so that they can staff the virtual call center, answer the questions, and collect that basic information and pass that over to our eligibility technicians. We have met and we've briefed the union, and so they are aware of this. We're working with the Department of Administration on emergency contracting, in addition to working with the Department of Law. We did not take this decision lightly. We really wanted to look at every avenue. But when Alaskans are going hungry, malnutritious, we will need to make sure that we're getting those benefits out quickly. And so we are pursuing an emergency contract for staffing that is time limited. The third piece is crisis communication. There's a lot of Alaskans that are frustrated and they want to know what is happening with what is the state doing, what's the department doing, addressing the backlog. It is most unfortunate that all three of my PIO positions are currently vacant. So we are working together in a mighty team. And so we have a small contract for additional support to help us with what I call crisis communication. Again, we need to be proactive in communicating and reaching out to Alaskans and letting them know what is the status, what are we doing, how they can help themselves as in not submitting multiple applications, as an example. And then again, preparing us for the redetermination for Medicaid clients that will be happening in April. The fourth immediate area that we're focusing on is a lot of our staff are concerned. There's been a lot of frustrated Alaskans, and it's most unfortunate that there's been a lot of threats to the staff in the offices. And we take workplace safety it's paramount, it's important, and I want to make sure that our staff feel safe going into the office. And so we have two contracts. One is to do a security evaluation for all of the DPA offices to ensure that they are safe. And two, to have security guards that can actually engage and de-escalate situations and provide medical support when needed in our four larger offices. And then finally, we continue to recruit and to onboard both permanent eligibility technicians, and we do have 45 long-term non-perm positions that we're continuing to recruit for. So that's the underpinning that's continuing to happen, but we also need to engage in these other efforts for immediate focus in addressing this backlog. So I believe this is my last slide, and then we can get to questions. You know, I view my role as it's listening, it's meeting with advocates, it's meeting with providers, it's meeting with clients, and I know together that we can solve these problems. And so, you know, a lot of people have come to us with solutions on addressing the SNAP backlog. And so I just wanted to highlight eight of the suggestions from partners and sort of the department's position in what we're doing. So the first one was lengthening certification periods. So we absolutely agree. DPA is implementing food and nutrition services, also known as FNS, options to change our SNAP certification periods from 6 months to 12 months for all SNAP households, except those in which all household members are elderly or disabled and have no earned income. Those household members who are elderly or disabled and have no earned income will continue to be certified at 24 months with a touch base at every 12 months. This is part of the EIS system, part of the reprogramming that I had mentioned. The reprogramming started this month, January 2023, and once it's completed, it will be fully implemented. So the timeline that we're looking at right now for lengthening the certification period, March, the programming is going to take 3 months. And then in March, they're going to be testing the reprogramming and seeing if it works. And if everything works, then tentatively, we're going to be training our staff and implementing around the May-June timeframe. All of this is predicated that we, again, find the additional staff to support and that we make sure that the reprogramming was successful during the testing phase. So that was the first suggestion. The second suggestion was waiving unnecessary interviews. We agree, and Alaska received a waiver from FNS granting this flexibility for applications and recertifications for the period of October 1st, 2022, to September 30th, 2023. The third suggestion was streamlining the review of housing, utilities, and dependent care costs. We agree, we want to streamline, and so to streamline workflow and increase eligibility processing timelines, DPA is amending the shelter and utility expense verification process to temporarily suspend the requirement for verification and accept the client's statement. The fourth suggestion was to implement broad-based categorical eligibility. The department will review this option again. We put this consideration on hold when the prior federal administration proposed a rule that would have ended the broad-based eligibility nationwide. And so now we just need to review it again and see if that's feasible. The fifth suggestion was to extend 1 month of SNAP benefits for all who are delayed because of the agency's faults. And as I have mentioned, again, due to system limitations, the case that is worked, it needs to be worked manually and touched by an eligibility technician. There's no way to go back into that one case to give them one additional month. That eligibility technician, when they're in there, we want them to complete that whole case. The sixth recommendation was to establish a cost-effective threshold and compromise overpayment claims. The department will review our practices and options under the federal program rules. The seventh recommendation was to recruit and train more fee agents, and we agree. The division recognizes that the fee agents are a valuable tool in supporting efficient administration of the SNAP benefits. One of the barriers to expanding the use of fee agents is a federal regulation that limits the use of fee agents to those communities not within 50 miles of a DPA office. So DPA plans to expand the fee agents in twofold. First, we're going to seek a waiver of the federal regulation due to the extraordinary temporary situation that we're currently in. To increase the applications. And then second, we're going to increase the outreach to find individuals willing to serve these fee agents. We do have a staff member that is focused on recruiting the fee agents, so that's good. We just need to get a waiver from the feds on the 50-mile radius. And then finally is the improving the website capacity. So the division has developed an online application that includes the ability for clients to submit supporting documentation online. Currently, the online application is in the queue to be reviewed by the IT Security Office to ensure the system meets the requirements, the required security elements to prevent hackers from attacking the system and safeguarding the personal health information. That's one of our pinch points, is that we have one person in our security office, and there's a laundry list of elements that have to be addressed. So it is in the queue, it is prioritized, but I don't have a timeline on when that security plan is going to be reviewed. So that is the end of our presentation, and I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you, Commissioner Designee. And just to let folks know, there are a couple more slides.
It's fine.
It is a good breaking point that we can start the questions. We do have you guys scheduled to come back before the committee on the 31st to go a little bit more in depth into some of the organizational structure. We didn't allow you to have time to talk about your background, even though you just started, that you've been with the department for many years, and the same for DC Ritchie, who may have just started in her that role, but she has many accomplishments within the state government and services, and one of the reasons why we have some of our cheap health care rates and as a policy of our health policy administrator for many years. And so you have many years of experience. We'll let you to tell the committee and this building a little bit more about that, as you're also up for confirmation. And so we would love to learn a little bit more about you, but just because of some where we're currently at with the situation, we just thought we would start questions on SNAP benefits, and then if there's time, so time, we can go into that the following Tuesday. So I hope everyone parking lotted their questions to ask. And so with that, we'll open up for questions. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have several questions, so I don't know if you want to do one at a time.
One at a time and just work through and come on back.
So I'll do one question, okay. And then we'll go.
One question, follow-up.
One question. the lengthening of certification periods. So I'm curious about federal requirements and the degree to which we are limited by federal requirements on this program. Apparently, we can go from 6 months to 12 months because you're doing that. I'm a little disappointed to hear that it wasn't already 12 months. That would have stopped a lot of this. Property tax exemptions, for example, in Anchorage are 12 months. I think our car registration now is 2 years, if I'm not mistaken. So my specific question is, why not go to 2 years? If we can do it for seniors, why can't we do it for other folks? Are we prevented by federal regulations from doing it for other folks?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, my understanding is we're limited by FMS rules and regulations that we are only allowed to go up to 12 months.
And can I ask a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair? So how difficult will it be to go from 6 months to 12 months? How quickly can we go from 6 months to 12 months?
So through the chair, Senator Dunbar, so the goal is right now we need to program the EIS system, and that's going to be January, February, in March. If the programming goes well, March is when they're going to be testing those systems. And again, if that testing works out, then we're going to be looking at training our staff and implementing in that May, June timeframe. If everything goes smoothly, then it's going to be faster. If it doesn't, then it's going to take longer. But that is one of our priorities for IT, is the reprogramming, because we recognize moving it from 6 months to 12 months will decrease the number of contacts that we have and will create more efficiencies.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Through the chair, Commissioner, I have a question regarding the programmer. I'm assuming we had more programmers at some point in time and we have lost those individuals. So I'm curious to know what happened? Why do we only have one who is available? And as I see, as we go into this online application and we have some other systems, I'm hoping we have more than one programmer for those systems. And if we don't, how and what do we need to do to ensure that those individuals in those positions are staffed?
Yeah, so through the Senator, Senator Tobin, we actually have 10 IT positions that are in the budget. It's sort of a twofold answer. One, I think it was really highlighted during the May 2021 cyber attack that there's an IT deficit, a technology deficit, and that our systems are overburdened and overrun. And I think with everything that's been happening over the past 4 years with the physical crisis that we have all been working through, I think it was multifactorial that it just didn't rise up until now. with the department split, there's a lot more time to really focus in on these division operations. And so that's where this deep dive into DPA. I had no idea that we only had one person, and she's amazing, and I really want to make sure that she stays with us. And but we do have many IT staff. I don't have the number off the top of my head. We can follow up with you, but we have one person that knows these antiquated IT languages, which is why we've had to contract out with two different sources to help her.
All right. Senator Coffin.
Thank you. Through the chair to Commissioner Designee Hedberg, or as you may want to defer it out to the team, when I visited in Anchorage, we talked about your improvement project around IT and, you know, the resources and all of that. And we discussed kind of your matrix that you work with. And I looked at it in terms of a integrated resource loaded schedule. So this is what you've got to do. This is your calendar for doing it. Here's all the resources you need. I'm just wondering, have you looked any further into that, or in looking at it that way? The matrix may be fine. I'm just interested if any of the concepts that we talked about managing improvement projects, if that came to anything, or if you looked at what you've got and that's fine.
So through the chair, Senator Coffin, I think we developed the IT matrix out of just necessity, because when the cyber attack took down all the department IT systems, we really had to go through categorically and understand the impacts, and it really required everyone, not just public assistants, to go to manual processes. I mean, it was a significant burden to Alaskans and to the department. And so we didn't really have a one list of all of our IT systems. And so through that process, created the matrix. I think we also needed to be more organized with the process for approvals of IT systems and looking at off-the-shelf products versus what needs to be built. Our IT staff are coordinated into project management, security office, and business applications. And so through those three groups that are under the umbrella of IT, they really are the ones that are looking at all of these IT systems. And there is an Excel document that kind of lists what is the deficit, what is the need, and what's the priority, because we can't work on all of the IT systems across the department. I think that is going to change over the years. I think this is the first step in us organizing and looking at what are the needs and what are these integrated systems that we need to move. We need to move off of the mainframe, right? What are these other systems that we need to move off of and into the cloud? And I know that the Office of Information Technology has a huge focus and initiative to move these systems into the cloud, which is more secure.
All up, Senator?
Well, thank you for now.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Senator Giesel.
So, Commissioner Designee, you referred to the budget cuts that have been going on. They've actually been going on for several years. It's not new. You also identified 1 in 3 Alaskans depend on your services. This is another statistic that I've been aware of for several years as well. You have staffing issues. What do you see that we could do to help you staff up?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, that's a great question. I think that the needs are different in each of the divisions. For IT, I'm really, again, focusing on the immediate solutions. And with the Department of Family and Community Services, the roadmap is really important, because we really need to assess across both departments as we are splitting both of the staff and the resources and the knowledge of those IT systems, that it's fair and equitable, and that if there is a delta, that we address that. And I think once that roadmap is completed, I think then we can engage in a conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm gonna jump in here in the queue. On slide 21, you have sort of how what you're doing to address the backlog. I just want to make sure that we have clear communications and that we can clearly manage sort of the expectations. If everything you listed here is completed, what's the time frame to address the backlog? Are we talking 2 weeks or are we talking 6 to 8 weeks?
To the chair, that is the question that I get asked multiple times a day is, if you have these additional resources, how quickly are you able? And I don't know. That's the honest answer, is I'm not sure. The eligibility technicians had a high production day on Friday, and it was great. And so they really are going through that October backlog. It's less than 900 right now, so they really are focused. But we recognize that we need these resources. I would love to tell you a time frame, but I don't know how accurate it's going to be. I think once these contracts are signed, they're not signed yet, I think that we'll have a better estimate, and then we can follow up and let you guys know.
Yeah. So I just want to make sure that we're not going to set something up to say, hey, we have these. It's not going to be an overnight process, that we are talking literal weeks to, you know, out before we can start to really address the majority of the backlog, that it's not something that we can just turn key and say, here's everything you need and you're just going to fix this overnight. But it will take time to train folks on the new systems, to get them up, and as you said, to enter the data. So we are talking weeks, month, you know, a month plus before we can really start to make a dent in the backlogs. And I do want to say congratulations to fixing the backlog with background checks, because that was a huge accomplishment to get it down back to 4 days. Is a great achievement. So I just want to say thank you for getting that all under control, and we look forward to addressing this. I think Senator Dunbar had a...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have several more questions. I'll try to limit one at a time. I think the question you just asked, though, is probably the most important. It's just, I think we're all driving at this. Like, how long is this going to take, and what can we do? And perhaps there's nothing we can do at this stage. It's just going to be as long as it's going to be. One of my questions is about, you mentioned the website capacity, and there's one person at the security office that can work on that. Is that another thing that we could do some kind of outside contract for? As you've mentioned, I think it was the VCC, or there was another place where you were doing an outside contract. Could you do some kind of time-limited outside contract to improve the website and address this sort of choke point of just having one person in the security office?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Dunbar. That is a great question, and that is something that we have been exploring within the Department of Health. We also partner with the Office of Information Technology, OIT, with the Department of Administration. We came to them with, like, here are our needs. This is how can you help us? And so we've been, right now we're sort of in the analysis of what that looks like, who has the capacity to help us with the security reviews for each of these security plans.
Follow up, Senator?
Actually, my other question is on a different topic, so I'll wait in the queue. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you so much. This has been really helpful. And so I'm going to ask a question that I have received from many of my constituents, and I'm sure many folks here have also received a lot of questions from their constituents, which is, if someone is interested in applying for one of these positions, where would they get that information? Where would they look? I have several folks who receive these benefits, and they want to help. They're really curious of how they can be part of the solution.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Tobin. I have to tell you, when I called a client back and listened to her story, at the very end, she said, I want to help. What do I do? So it's the same. It is fantastic. It's a great question. On Workplace Alaska, we are posting these positions. It's not a continuous enrollment. So what is happening right now is that it's posted. There's a bunch of applications that are received. The staff take it back. They review the applications, complete the interviews, ask for approvals to hire, and then they're onboarding. So they're doing their onboarding and recruiting in cohorts. And so I just looked 2 days ago. I did not see the eligibility technician listed, but it continuously pops up, and we're happy to flag that and send it to all of you. It has been one of my messages, is everyone is welcome to come work with us. And we have other positions available as well.
Yes. Follow-up, Senator?
Follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will make a plug for the PIO position, as it sounds like you have three open, and I am a big advocate of crisis communications as someone who worked in the nonprofit sector and communications for a long time. It's critical work. Thank you.
I guess we're moving on to Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, and this may not be something the department can really answer, but when I hear the 1 in 3 statistic, I'm wondering what aren't we doing to minimize demand? Why do we have such a high demand on the department? And we can try and beef up our capacity to deal with that, but I think somehow demand minimization is really what we can focus on to reduce your workload and make it easier to accomplish. Now, I don't know what that is right now. I have ideas, but I won't go there right now. But I think we need to look at that. What can we do? A core piece of this project should be demand reduction right off the bat. Thank you.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Huffman, I just want to mention that we do have a partnership with Nine Star. So, and they are actually funded through the Division of Public Assistance. And so, again, my vision would be how to create an easy on-ramp and a quick off-ramp, because we do want to meet the needs of our vulnerable Alaskans. We want to make sure that there's an off-ramp and that we can support those Alaskans where they're at and making sure that they can connect into employment that brings fulfillment to them.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just going to go back the same way, Senator Giesel.
So that, of course, raises the question of, I bet these folks will need childcare. So perhaps that's a thing we should solve. I missed the part where you talked about 4 days for a background check. I'd like to know how you did that and why DCCED isn't doing that for professional licensing.
I'm going to turn that over to Emily.
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, for the record, this is Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health. The 4 days for the background check is those, I just want to make sure we're clarifying, those are 4 business days from when a complete application is received. And there's multiple parts of a background check application that need to be submitted at the same time, the application, the fee, and the background check, the fingerprints itself. That number is kind of within the goal of healthcare services, which is a 3 to 5 day processing time. As I said earlier in the presentation, in the fall, those processing times admittedly became much longer as they were dealing with some staff vacancies, attrition, and I don't want to keep harping on the 2021 cyber attack, but that has had kind of a ripple effect as all of these different divisions within the department had to move to manual processes and then switch back from manual to automated. And so that also had an impact on the longer background check unit times. I'm happy to report that healthcare services has addressed that and we're back to the 4 day processing. I can't necessarily speak to other divisions or departments. I'm still getting my feet on the ground with this one. But that's what I can report out for what we call the BCU or the background check unit.
Yes, Senator Giesel.
So I'm hearing, tell me the person goes to the business there in Anchorage. And it's an electronic process. You put your hand on a screen, they capture the fingerprints. But then they print them out. Do you require them to be delivered to you on a paper format, or will you take them electronically?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, I would say the majority of the time the division does require that those be printed out. So it is a manual process. And this is part of the way the system has been developed between the Department of Public Safety and the Division of Healthcare Services. The Department of Public Safety, or the Division of Public Safety, is actually the entity that processes the fingerprints. And so that manual process is part of what's necessary because, going back to IT systems, you don't have the IT system connectivity and coordination that you might need to make it electronic. There's also some security issues that are starting to come up in other states. So there are electronic means that are used in other areas to process those fingerprints. This is an issue that I've spent a lot of time talking about with healthcare services fairly recently, trying to wrap my head around how can we do this better? And it's not for lack of desire or effort, I think, on either entity's part. It gets back to this system that we struggle with, which is how to make these IT systems talk to each other, and where do you put this type of effort in a prioritization when we're dealing with the staff issues, the Division of Public Assistance, the fiscal agent transitions that are happening. It's this technology debt that Commissioner Designee spoke about earlier.
Mr. Chairman, just a comment. You know, one of the five of us will probably end up on the budget subcommittee related to this department. This needs to be funded. Something to keep in mind. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just really want to echo what Senator Giesel just said. I believe the Department of Defense, for example, with their security clearance process now is all electronic or very nearly so. And it just seems like if we can do that, then it's got to be possible to make this electronic. But my question was about, Commissioner Designee, through the chair, you had mentioned the split of the department. I know we're going to get into that later and not so much today, but you'd mentioned the split of the department had caused some IT challenges or you were trying to identify sort of the IT resources in both directions. And I'm new to this position, as are you, and so I wasn't here when that happened. But I thought there had been some money, maybe $15 million, something in that range, for the department to facilitate the split. And I'm wondering if that money, first of all, is it gone? Although I guess that's for next time. But could that money be used to accelerate and pay for these IT assets? My experience in Anchorage with the sort of notorious things that have happened there is that IT is phenomenally expensive. And so I'm wondering if you can use those resources on IT as the split happens.
So through the chair, Senator Dunbar, is the question the funding from the current year 23 on the department split, or just using funding right now to address the deficits within IT staff?
Again, I don't have enough. Yeah, I'll say both because I don't have the knowledge to answer your question to my question yet.
Okay. So through the chair, I am going to actually have to ask for a lifeline on the funding for the department split.
For the record, Heather Carpenter, Healthcare Policy Advisor, as one of the lone ladies standing. there was not exactly $15 million. We can recirculate the financial support that went to the department split. We had some documents that I think will help the newer members to just reorient to that. Most of that money was spent on reclassing certain positions. We did have to add a couple of new positions since the department split. We needed a department technology officer for both departments. We needed an ASD for both departments. So there were some strategic investments that just allowed us to perform our work. So we have some documents we provided last year that we can recirculate that'll just highlight what that funding went for with the department split.
I know there's going to be lots of acronyms, but for new members, an ASD is a...
Admin Services Director. We also call that position the Assistant Commissioner in the Department of Health because it is so much more than just the budget. It's over all of that Department of Finance and Management Services. So that is Ms. Josie Stern, who is new to her position in the department this year.
Thank you. All right. Sure. Oh. Maybe we can talk about this at your next meeting. I don't expect you guys to have an answer on this, but on, I believe, slide 12, when we start talking about 1115 waivers, I was at a Medicaid leadership conference where we got to hear from the CMS Medicaid director for feds and a couple of other Medicaid directors within that and some of my counterparts across the nation all met in D.C. in September-ish. We talked about 1115 waivers and how it's now becoming overburdensome for CMS to process 1115 waivers, and it would be faster and more efficient for states now because of the requirements of the, you have to show the proof and keep the data collection and reapply and then show the cost savings analysis that if you already have successful 1115 waivers, you're looking to do more that are very similar to that, and you have the data and background that it would actually be faster and more efficient for states to start rewriting their state plans. Has the department looked at rewriting our state Medicaid plan? Just because they're in separate offices, the CMS at the federal level, and honestly, they said the people that would do the state plans are just, I don't want to say basically twiddling their thumbs, but they have a lower caseload versus the 1115 waiver side, and they could probably process those a lot faster and quicker with more efficiency than going through the hurdles of the 1115 waiver or the other waivers as well, 1118. And I know there's so many different waiver programs, but they're just asking, why aren't states just rewriting state plans? And like I said, you can answer that now, or you can come back to the committee in a week to go through that.
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, or to the chair, Senator Wilson, for the record, this is Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health. So I will try to answer that now and follow up with maybe a more robust answer. But I would say that every conversation I've had, whether it's with the Division of Behavioral Health, the Division of Senior and Disability Services, or Healthcare Services, where we're looking at thinking about, okay, what do we need to change? How can we improve this? How do we get from where we are right now to where we want to be in terms of looking at benefit changes or additions? And particularly in the Division of Behavioral Health, you have the 1115 waiver services, and then you have the state plan services. And to your point, sometimes it may make more sense to pursue an 1115 waiver or modification versus a state plan modification. Both processes are very intense. The state plan amendment may be at points less intense, but not always, depending on literally the page that of the state plan that requires the change and what is on that page. Because once you begin discussions on amending a paragraph, anything else on that page is up for review between the state and the federal government. And so there's a lot of calculus and very careful thought before any changes are proposed to literally the specific page of the state plan amendment, to make sure that anything on that page is something that may be potentially open to change or negotiation. And so that balance is very carefully reviewed for kind of the calculus as to like what is most efficient to get to where we need to go. And so it really depends on the service and, quite frankly, where the paragraph is within that state plan amendment, within that state plan.
Seems like every paragraph should be its own page.
I was going to say, you should increase the font size. Increase the font size.
I'm going to go back to Dunbar first, and then Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for all these questions. I'll try to be quick. So on page 19, going back to the SNAP question just briefly, so through the chair to the commissioner designee, you'd said that the virtual call center, people were able to resolve these issues on the phone before they got overwhelmed. So can you sort of describe what those folks at the call center were doing? That is, were they in all of these nine systems? Were they using COBOL or these like almost a DOS-related things? I mean, that, or did they have some other data entry system? And if they did, is there any way to sort of flip that around and let the public use whatever it was the people at the VCC were using? Because I just don't understand. They were on the phone, yet they were using all these nine systems to enter the data simultaneously. Is that what was happening?
So through the chair, Senator Dunbar, I will probably have to defer the question, but I'll kind of give the general sort of overview right now. August of 2022 is when we received 8,000 SNAP recertifications. That was the last element that just sort of like crumbled and created that backlog. And so the callers started calling, and there was a pitch at October, which is where we had to make that change. And so when the intent, again, is when I call into the virtual call center, my call is answered in a timely manner, my application is at least started, and then it goes on to the next stage. It depends on the level of and complexity of the application. When I talk to the leadership team in DPA or eligibility technicians, you know, sometimes if it's an entire house of like 8 to 10 people, it can take 8 hours to go through all of those applications. Versus a single person in single application can take, you know, maybe 40 minutes to an hour. So it really is very dependent.
the virtual call center, there were people that were spending, you know, 30, 45 minutes on the phone helping process those applications, but we couldn't spend that much time when the call volume increased. So every time somebody calls in, we are able to track every call that comes in, the number of people that just drop the call or they select they want to call back. We also record all of the calls for quality improvement. We want to make sure that we're always improving those phone calls. So my understanding is that that eligibility technician was collecting the information, doing what they could to process that application within the time frame that they have before October. This temporary solution that we have right now where we are just answering the call, answering basic questions, collecting basic information, shortens the length of the call. It's not the intent to remain that way. I think once our systems are connected and operating, the intent is that we would go back to when you call the virtual call center, you would receive that customer service of processing that application up to the point of whatever is needed during that call, and if there's a follow-up, that there would be a scheduled follow-up. So we do desire to go back to answering the call and processing the applications on the virtual call center. Temporarily, we have to suspend that, though, so we can just do the most basic. And again, which is where we have to pivot and bring in additional staff to support the virtual call center so I can take my seasoned staff to focus on processing the applications, again, while we're in this backlog of this crisis.
That's a very quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I guess what I'm trying to get at, though, is can we head off some of it, head it off at the pass? So folks aren't even calling the call center. Whatever it is that the technician is entering the system into, can we put that online, or is it already online, so that folks can just do it themselves without calling the call center?
So through the chair, Senator Dunbar, the virtual call center is really the eligibility technicians, again, equitable access across the state. The forms are still paper. And so that is where we want to move these forms online.
Yes, we do.
All of the, it's a puzzle piece, right? We want a virtual call center with a timely response, a timely, you know, call. And then we want online applications for as many public, you know, assistance programs as we can. We desire to move towards that. We recognize the deficit that we have with IT resources, including IT staff. And that's where we are triaging and saying, this is what we're focusing on first. And then again, the roadmap is where we're going to focus on the long-term solutions, because it's not just the Division of Public Assistance. Our other four divisions, specifically the Division of Public Health, there's a lot of IT, there's a lot of data repository, and we want to get that data out visually so that community leaders are informed as they're making policy decisions. So I think overall what you're going to hear over the next 4 years is really just this modernization of our IT systems and getting this information out so that it's visually accessible. Dr. Ann Zink likes to say, health in your hand, right? So every Alaskan has their information in their hand, and that's the goal that we aim to go towards.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And then last quick question.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. This is actually on slide 4 and 5. However, I just want to echo what Senator Dunbar is saying is it's really critical to have equitable access of these systems, but we know that many Alaskans don't have broadband or internet access. We know many Alaskans don't speak English fluently or as a first language, and so having a virtual call center, having online, and having paper are all critical pieces. My question is actually around TV. We know that I am from rural Alaska. I love rural Alaska. It's near and dear to my heart. I am concerned about the surge of TB and STIs in rural Alaska. I love public health, and camp is something that I participated in Nome. And so one of my questions is, and it's a very specific one, is I know we stopped TB testing in schools. And so I'm curious of how that has impacted this surge, or if it's impacted. I think it's just a question I have. I know some of the public has also had some inquiry as well.
Great. Through the chair, for the record, this is Dr. Ann Zink, and through the chair to Senator Tobin. Fantastic question. We, too, are very concerned. If you look at the epidemiology of our TB cases, it primarily is in our rural regions, particularly the YK Delta. And, in fact, Alaska has its own strain of tuberculosis that we've had for a long time. and really during the 1930s and 40s and 50s caused just huge death and loss in that region. And there's still a huge historical traumatic impact of the historical impact of tuberculosis. The reason for the change for tuberculosis in schools is not to not test kids or not test schools, but sometimes the school might not be the best place to do it. It might make more sense at the clinic. And so the idea behind that was to be able to be as nimble as possible to respond to the challenges and the needs in a community, and has been considered best practices both by the CDC as well as the Curry Center, which is an international center looking at tuberculosis practice. So it was in consultation with them that they said, you know, let's look at how we can make this most effective as possible. If this is, you know, when people are coming back from fish camp, this is going to a family and doing directed TB cases. I think that the reason for the high rates of TB cases right now are multifactorial. First of all, we started with higher rates of tuberculosis. Second of all, the pandemic, people were not testing. We weren't treating. We weren't going out into communities to do the screening. Tuberculosis is a disease that oftentimes is latent. People don't know that they have the disease. They can silently spread it from person to person. And it takes a lot of time and effort and work to identify those cases when people are still very amenable to treatment. And then treatment for tuberculosis is really hard as well. And this is one of our big limitations. And I appreciate you mentioning broadband and access. Really watching someone take their tuberculosis medication, what we call direct observational therapy, is critical for the success and to reduce the risk of multi-drug resistant tuberculosis. So that's a really critical aspect. But if you don't have broadband, if you don't have a healthcare worker in that community, if someone's not incentivized to every single day take their medications for 4 months or 6 months or 9 months, and that's a long time to take a bunch of medication, that can be really problematic, particularly as people are moving between, you know, hubs and homes and fish camps and all sorts of other places. We also know that people live in tight, congested communities, and that is another setup for transmission of tuberculosis. So it's really multifactorial, but really during this pandemic, when we had a hard time getting out to communities, doing that hardcore preventative work, really identifying cases, we saw that rise. It's been hard to get our public health nursing kind of upstaffed again to be able to go back out there. We're really grateful for our partners that particularly the Waikiki Delta region we're working with very closely. They're taking a lot of their COVID dollars that they had left and what they could do to be able to use their contact tracing information. We've been kind of partnering. We actually just had a couple hour meeting on a strategic plan on what we can do differently. We need funding for it, and that's part of the reason you see it in the governor's budget. It's hard and labor and time intensive, but this is a disease that ravaged America for years, and unfortunately we are really experiencing a rise in these cases. And if we are able to get them down, then it's not a disease we have to worry about in the same sort of way. So it's critical we act now.
All right. Well, I'm going to say thank you, and we look forward to seeing you guys next week to continue these same slides with additional information. I know you have questions from our committee members. If committee members have any additional questions they would like to get answers to, please submit them to us so we can try to incorporate that into the next week's presentation. Are there any closing comments from committee members? Seeing none. On Thursday, January 26th, we'll hear an overview from the Department of Family and Community Services, and we are adjourned at 5:02 p.m.